Welcome to a new edition of the podcast. This is Milton Rosenberg, and on a cell phone from elsewhere is my guest for the occasion, namely Nathan Hardin, whom you see sometimes as a contributor to this website itself, the website being ricochet.com. I say that for those of our listeners who are not at that website, but at our other website, namely miltonrosenberg.com. And coming directly to it, Nathan, you are a graduate of Yale University. That makes you one of the truly elect of this society, does it not?
Guilty as charged, yes. Did you say elect or elite?
Elect and elite, both, of course.
Elitism has gone out of fashion in our culture, so I'll try to dodge that one. But yes, I did attend and graduated in 2009, and had a very great, good experience for the most part, but had some less than great experiences as well.
And those less than great experiences, as you define them, are detailed in a book published, I guess, about a year ago, Sex and God at Yale, subtitled Porn, Political Correctness, and A Good Education Gone Bad. Sex and God at Yale, of course, is an intended play on the famous Buckley title of so many years ago, God and Man at Yale. Now it's God and Man and Women at Yale, less God and much more sex, apparently.
See, that should have been the title. I should have thought of that. God and Man and Women at Yale. Yes, things have changed a bit since Buckley's time, for sure.
Give us the picture of the worst. Your book is about the worst, and you do suggest that Yale still can provide a good education. I worry about whether it can at all, because quite apart from the excessive, weird sexualization of the Yale culture, there is the question of the political correctness side of the academic culture, which I think is as pervasive at Yale as it is at my institution of more recent employment, namely the University of Chicago, where virtually all members of the humanities departments and of the social science departments are essentially left-wing in orientation, some Marxist or Marxoid, and rather annoyed at the conventional verities of liberal education.
Yes, I think a good way of describing Yale specifically, but a lot of elite higher education in the country right now, is morally adrift. And we all see that, you know, in these sort of news stories that come out all the time about, you know, crazy frat parties or whatever else people imagine is going on in our colleges and universities, sex and drugs and rock and roll and so forth. But the other side of it is the academic decline. And I think that in the long term might be just as important of a story. And part of what I tried to do in the book is to link these two together. And I make the argument that I go into great detail about some rather shocking moral degradation that's going on in the classroom, mind you, not talking about just what students are doing in their dorm rooms or at parties or so forth, but really I focus on what's being presented to them, you know, from the lectern.
Well, good. We'll turn to that after we first take an overview of the sexualization of Yale.
Sure.
I was, as you know, at the very beginning of my academic career, an assistant professor in the psychology department at Yale. And that was Yale just before it went co-ed at the undergraduate level. And I can tell you something about sex at Yale way back then. There was probably a fair amount of it. The young men, the undergraduates, would bring women to university events, usually from one of the Seven Sisters women's campuses, or they would go off to New York or to Boston or
sure,
wherever, and have their weekend adventures. But propriety and probity were still the general attitude within Yale College itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now Yale is famous not so much for its great scholars, and some of them are people I know rather well. Donald Kagan is a particularly favored and beloved friend of mine.
Yeah, he is a former teacher of mine, yes.
Sure, lots of he's a great classicist and expert on Greek history and Greek military history. But the general sense one has is that the institution of Sex Week, as established at Yale, was not the beginning of its trouble, but a full confirmation of its decline into something really rather off-putting and unwholesome, or at least rather disappointing when one keeps in mind the values of a higher educational institution. I'm just setting the stage for you to now tell us, at least give us a précis, an overview of what you reveal in the book God and Sex at Yale.
Sure. Well, the most conspicuous evidence of Yale's moral decline is the infamous Sex Week at Yale, which people might have read about or heard about in the news over the years. This started at Yale about 10 years ago. And actually, it started quite innocently. Funny enough, it was something that the one of the students put together, and it was almost a religious event at first. It was supposed to be called Jewish Sex Week or something like that, and it was put on as a serious religious inquiry into the institutions of marriage and human sexuality and so forth. Well, very quickly that got thrown aside, and all the religious aspects of it were thrown out the door, and it became within a couple of years this sort of all comers event for, you know, the porn industry, the every sort of person coming in from the sex toy manufacturers to the porn companies to come sort of hawk their wares in front of Yale students in the name of serious sex education. And so by the time I arrived, which was maybe 5-6 years later, it was a completely one-sided event. There was very little in the way of serious conversations about sexuality or anything of that sort. It was sort of these ribald demonstrations of battery-powered sex toys and screenings of hardcore pornography on campus. In one particular case, there was a film was screened, I recall, that portrayed all of this violent sadomasochism, and there was quite a scandal on campus, and they had to shut the movie off in the middle of it because they were depicting something called fantasy rape, which I'm not even sure what that looks like on film coming out of our porn industry, but it certainly was a long way from the culture of propriety that you described maybe in the early 1960s.
Now, let me quickly trot out a few other necessary follow-on questions. One, what was the student response? How much student involvement and participation was there? What was the faculty response? How much faculty sponsorship or administration sponsorship was involved in setting up Sex Week at Yale? And last and maybe most important question, what about the weeks that are not Sex Week, which is the other 51 weeks, supposedly. And what kind of sexualization has kind of branched off from Sex Week?
Sure.
Is it in fact the case, as I read, that nude parties are a rather common social event, not merely during that one week, but throughout the year?
Yes. Well, that's a unique anomaly at Yale, the naked party that happens quite outside of Sex Week. So let me start with your first question, which is to what extent, you know, the administration or the faculty themselves are involved in organizing Sex Week at Yale. And that question depends on whether you want to believe the official story, which is the one that the Yale Press Office likes to tell to the media, or if you want to, you know, believe or know what is actually going on behind the scenes. So on the surface, Yale as an administration really tries to distance itself, not only because of the very sort of graphic nature. You know, I saw live nudity in the classroom, displays of the worst kind of woman objectifying filth and violence and sexual violence and so forth. They obviously are in no hurry to closely associate university with such things. On the other hand, they like to say that academic freedom requires them to do and to allow any sort of thing to happen in the classroom. This is their frequent defense when questioned, you know, how could you let things degrade thusly in the classroom? How could you let it fall so far? Well, they say, you know, we permit the widest range of ideologies, beliefs, practices, and so forth, because of academic freedom. And so this is what they, say in the press releases. This is what they will respond to, media inquiries about. On the other hand, behind the scenes, there were a number of faculty members who closely advised students. And I should point out that Sex Week is officially a student-organized event. So this is something that students themselves put together. The university provided some of the funding, and they allowed it. They provided the classroom space and some promotional materials and so forth. But it was actually, as it turned out, various corporate interests in the sex industry were funding all of this. So there was a sex toy manufacturer called Pure Romance, and they were giving $20,000-$30,000 a year to fund Sex Week for obvious reasons. It was a great marketing gimmick for them. I mean, they would come onto the campus of this hoity-toity elite university, you know, with bags full of battery-powered sex toys and the like. And before you knew it, Fox News and everybody else would be on campus, making these national headlines out of this. So it was great advertising. The same for Vivid Entertainment, which provided some support. They're the largest porn company in the country, and they would provide free porn, which would get passed out to students in the classroom, and they would basically look at it as a great way to promote themselves. Just this week, if you can believe this, a guy who runs a brothel out in Nevada emailed me. His PR person emailed me, wanted to know if I could help him get booked next year at Sex Week. And I thought to myself, you're talking to probably the last person in the country who can help you with that. But so the university is actually involved in providing, obviously classroom space for these events, which are approved on a case by case basis.
And the cover story is all respect for and commitment to academic freedom.
That's right.
Because
but as I explore elsewhere in the book, academic freedom is a very convenient term for them, which they use it when it fits their agenda, and other times they're not so keen on it.
What if some students got together who were enthusiasts of the Tea Party as a political movement and wanted to establish a Tea Party chapter on the Yale campus? Would they be free to do that? Would their academic freedom in terms of political preference be honored as well as the political preferences of some students who got a sexuality fix?
It would be allowed, but I can certainly say it wouldn't be honored on campus.
It would not get student unions support, so to speak.
Right. And I think that the question is, though, you know, you can't say that academic freedom is the same thing as having no academic standards. And that's the definition that Yale has employed. You wouldn't, for instance, expect to have a Ku Klux Klan week at Yale. You wouldn't expect to have a week dedicated to the degradation of the Jewish people and have a celebration of that only. You know, you would expect that if someone proposed that the Yale facility, the funding would be used for such a thing, that they would be sort of laughed off campus. Yeah. Nobody would even take that seriously. It would certainly never happen.
See, well, I'm getting a little eager to get in on this. Pardon me for being non-hostly and too participatory.
Sure.
But one thing that it seems to me really is not properly understood at Yale or by the administration, including the president of the university, is that this kind of this glorification of routinized sex and of machine-assisted sex, so to speak, and this general celebration of total latitudinarianism with regard to sexual expressiveness also tends to demean women. And there's a real difference between male and female sexuality. Some have argued that men are essentially interested in conquest when they're young. Women, even when they're young and in the premarital years, tend to get more attached in sexuality. The hookup culture, it is argued by some psychiatrists, has done some real injury to undergraduate co-eds at institutions generally. There's a female psychiatrist at University of California who's done a book on this based upon her own encounter with students who come through the student health service. So there is possibly some harm rather than mere excessive nihilistic indulgence of instinctuality, which may be a consequence of the sex week itself.
That's right. It is. It is partly a consequence of that. And I think it's great that you bring up the point about how our sexual culture affects women differently, because this is a cornerstone of the argument I make in Sex and God at Yale, because I think it's important to test the liberal elite's moral views as they claim to hold them. In other words, the leaders of Yale would fall over themselves to tell you that they are adamant supporters of women's rights, women's equality, feminists, that they would, to a man and to a woman, they would say that this is absolutely something they're committed to.
So would some of the feminist writers endorse Sex Week at Yale or the sexualized culture at Yale.
Oh, yes.
As some did in writing critical reviews of your book, in fact.
Yes, that's very true. Well, this is what the great conundrum of modern feminism, isn't it? It's that they, in fact, have, as a movement, have been one of the driving forces toward the liberalization of our sexual culture, toward what they viewed as a form of equality, and that, women could indulge in sex supposedly with as much ease and promiscuity as men without any ill consequence or without, any cultural stigma. Well, they have pushed this radical culture into being, and now we find, as you said yourself, that, well, it's not necessarily making very many young women happy. So the paradox here is that we have now what's known as the hookup culture, which emphasizes commitment-free, loveless sexuality. And this is something that many people of a generation or two ago just can't comprehend. So I'm not talking about, people going on a nice dinner and a movie, and then, things progress from there. I'm talking about alcohol-fueled random sexual encounters with acquaintances that are, in other words, they begin and end with a sexual relationship. And there's an incredible shift in the way young people now relate to one another sexually, especially at our elite colleges. The reason for that is that elite students and elite women especially feel a tremendous pressure to delay the onset of serious romantic commitment because it's feared that it could derail one's career opportunities. Love and marriage are seen as a big roadblock to women's equality in the workplace. And this is what we see coming out now with the big best-selling book now, Lean In, or some of these other popular feminist books now, the great sort of anxiety about how a woman can, quote-unquote, have it all in the home and in the workplace. Well,
the fact is that it's, according to some psychiatric observers and other social science-based observers and mere intelligent journalists, the fact is that full indulgence in the hookup culture, and at Yale, I should think full indulgence in the extra aspects of the culture keyed to Sex Week, may very well mis-equip or under-equip a young woman for ultimately settling and becoming capable of serious romantic commitment to some male. This may work against both males and females as they mature and as they hope for real love as we define it in this society, and the foundation of real working lasting families. It may well be that lots of the people who've gone through all of this sexual freedom through even at high school levels and certainly at college levels, because what's happening at Yale is happening at lots of other institutions to some degree or another, that all of this may lead them down paths which may produce or may be consistent with work success, but ultimately may work against familial success. What do you think?
Yes, well, I think that, it's very troubling to see actual happiness and fulfillment of young men or women sacrificed to any political agenda. And that's exactly what the modern feminist movement has asked young women to do, which is, to ignore one's desire for love. I think beyond all the other tragedies that may go along with the moral decay that I saw at Yale, the fact that so many of my classmates will not develop the ability to form a meaningful, loving relationship throughout their 20s. And perhaps that will affect them even beyond those years as they age. I think that's a terrible tragedy. And I think it's a very narrow view of what it means to be a meaningful and fulfilled human to simply define it in terms of one's salary or one's career achievement. I think it's wonderful that women have all of the career opportunities that they have in these modern times. But does that mean that we have to narrowly define what it means to be a successful woman to one's salary or to one's, making partner at a law firm? I think that's fine for some people if that's what fulfills them or makes them happy. But to say that, a young person, male or female, who chooses to marry or start a family or to prioritize human relationships, that's some sort of sign of failure, to me is a real perversion of what it means to be a human.
Do you on that basis, have you observed any difference in undergraduate male versus undergraduate female reaction to the sexualization of Yale? Obviously, some women are quite enthusiastic for it.
Sure.
And write in those terms. But is it equally acceptable to male and female undergraduates, or is it somehow more favored by the males than the females?
Well, I think the sexual culture, the hookup culture, which emphasizes, loveless, commitment-free, short-term sexual relationships, I think that definitely plays into the favor of your typical male undergrad. That is not to say that everybody is the same or that some women don't like the way things are, that many young men aren't happy, that there aren't more meaningful, lasting relationships. But it's definitely one-sided. And I think study after study has shown that women, on average, are much less happy with their sexual experiences in college than men. And there's a reason for that. But the feminists in this country would rather close their eyes and ears to that fact and simply say, keep marching on, don't fall in love, don't dare get married, and the worst thing you could possibly do is bear a child, because these things are going to derail you from some sort of, career achievement that we have decided will make you a meaningful person.
I'm sure that you don't. I'm sure you don't think that Yale is unique in these changes in its culture, but
not at all.
Is Yale in the lead, or are other places essentially committed to the same degree to overt sexuality on campus, nude marches? They have at Michigan, I know, which is another one of my. I got my doctorate at Michigan many, many years ago before I went to teach at Yale, and at Michigan now there's a nude march, which is an annual occasion.
Right.
To what degree is what's happened at Yale representative of transformations in the general academic culture, or to what degree does it represent merely the elite institutions, or to what degree is it uniquely Yale-y?
Well, I've described it mostly as a leading indicator. What's going on at Yale right now will be happening elsewhere in 5 years. And I've seen that. A great example of that is with the sex week phenomenon. It began at Yale, but now, you know, this curriculum of smut, this pornographic pioneering advance of Yale has been copied by universities all over the country. So there are similar sex week now going on at Northwestern, Duke, even Harvard has one now, and even many public universities, University of Washington, is doing this. And there's a very similar model. So, you know, porn companies or sex toy companies are brought in to give these sort of how-to lectures, I guess, on everything from, you know, how to perform oral sex better, or even how to masturbate. Or, I mean, these are kids at elite colleges, and you know, they need professional instruction on how to masturbate, apparently, if you were to believe that. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So I think what I see happening at Yale right now is extreme. And Yale, to be fair to them, they have had to dial back in the last year or two some of the more extreme elements of sex week, largely because of the tremendous negative publicity they received once scrutiny of these activities started to amp up and once the public became aware of it.
And you have become more or less the lead scrutinizer, have you not?
Well, I think I probably prompted more than a few alumni to tear up their donation envelopes last year.
Yeah.
And money talks, as we know. And so, yes, a few things have changed. But unfortunately, I think the overall direction of the sexual culture, which is continuing to emphasize, you know, these kind of shallow, unfulfilling sexuality, and to that's really not changing. And you know, we see young people delaying marriage, for instance, so later and later in life. And I seem to think that something is wrong in our elite culture if we're no longer able to be complete people. If we're no longer able to give ourselves to love anymore, then we've gone off track, I think.
You made some reference in our discussion, and you do much more in your book, about quite apart from sex week and quite apart from nude parties and so on, to sex in the classroom. That is, what happens in the sexualization of the curriculum itself. Tell us something about that.
Sure. Well, the biggest example of that would be during sex week, where, I attended things that you can't even believe happened. If I hadn't been there with my own eyes and ears to see it, and I mentioned before, you know, I saw a porn star stripped down naked in front of the class and put on all of these sadomasochistic devices. And I mean, it was really rather, just an unbelievable is the only word you can think of. And this is in the same classroom where I had studied international relations.
That's what I was about to ask you. What class was that?
Yes. Well, this was a sex week event that was taking place in that classroom. But I think if you want to look at what's going on in terms of the curriculum, you know, the other 51 days of the year, I think you have to look at the effects, number one, of the undercutting or the delegitimization of religious faith in the academy. So it's now become almost something to snicker at if you happen to be a person of faith, or if you you hold to a religious belief. So dominant has the secular humanist ideology become. And I think if you want to go back to William F. Buckley's book, God and Man at Yale, which it's been over 50 years ago now since I came out, the problem he was pointing to then, his complaints then were very small complaints compared to what's going on now. He said that the university was sort of drifting off into socialist collectivist economics on the one hand. Now, on the other hand, it was you know, advancing an atheistic worldview and sort of demeaning the religious faith that it was founded upon. And 50 years later, I mean, look at what Yale has become. It's certainly a fulfillment of the prophecy that Buckley gave us long ago.
What is your overall socio-historical explanation of this pattern of change that has come upon American higher education and has to some degree become a part of the American general culture? That is, the preference for sort of a low, adventurous definition of sexual encounter rather than a decoupling of sexual life from the possibility of true emotional attachment and true familial implications, and perhaps even a general coarsening of the culture, which allows all sorts of things to flourish, which would have been interdicted, at least in terms of public performance in the past. If that's true at Yale, and if Yale in a way is a harbinger of or a symbol of a more general trend of that sort in American higher education, and if that trend in American higher education is representative of the society generally, what accounts for it? Why did it happen this way?
I think it's important that we recognize the fundamental shift that took place when the internet became mainstream. And what a powerful changing force that was on youth culture. And the biggest thing that did is it took pornography, which was something that has existed for ages, but it's always been sort of a hidden thing, or took place in back alleys and men slurped into, you know, theaters on Times Square with their collars pulled high above their around their chin. Well, now it took that sort of hidden aspect of our culture, and it brought it out in the mainstream. It brought it out in the open, and now, and it also amplified the extremeness, if I can say that, of porn. And I'm talking about violence and pornography. I'm talking about extreme sorts of everything from, you know, with animals to bloodshed to anything, any horrible thing you can imagine. It's right there, you know, two clicks away on a computer. And kids are exposed to this from the youngest of ages, you know, 18 years old. They're getting their sex education, in other words, not from, you know, from a parent or from, you know, their classmates at school telling this or that, or not even from, you know, a clipping out of a Playboy magazine or something like, you know, might have happened a generation or two ago. Now they're seeing the most vile and most extreme sorts of pornography, and this has really changed the baseline. It's really reoriented normal for young people. And so these things that are happening out in the open are not so shocking to people my age as they might have been to my parents, because they've, in a sense, seen so much already. I think what's disturbing about what's going on at Yale is that Yale has sort of accepted this this pornographic ethos without protest and without any scrutiny whatsoever, and allowed these same people to have a platform at a place that really ought to be about exploring the great ideas of human history. I mean, this is the place where Dante, Shakespeare, Plato, and Aristotle, these are the great thinkers whose ideas ought to be discussed, and indeed they are discussed there. But what place among these great thinkers and among these great ideas does a smut peddler from Los Angeles have to come and pass out his DVDs to students, or to someone else to teach you how to masturbate? I mean, it's really a degradation of the educational enterprise.
Well, you know, I think that maybe even the great classics will get redefined. And some of them will be put aside. Dante will be put aside. Even Plato and Aristotle might be put aside for other classics of a different order, which are still viewed as classic literature. For example, the Satyricon of Petronius Arbiter, or for that matter, the Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel, both of which feature a great deal of noisy and aberrant and constant sexuality. There's a thought.
Nothing would surprise me. I think if Dante could come back now, he would have to revise the Divine Comedy to create a new circle of hell, and it would be it would entail a sex week at a modern elite university.
Right. Yes.
And maybe a masturbation seminar. You know, it's really sad to see these great institutions taken down the road to absurdity like this.
How does it relate to or connect with or correlate with the right-left dimensionality in American political thought? For example, Hillsdale College is on the right in political thought and in all that it stands for. So is Grove City College. When it comes to major institutions, I don't know. But in general, there's a strong leftward trend in American universities, in the humanities and social science departments, rather than in the hard sciences or the schools of engineering. In law schools, we find a considerable shift to the left, and indeed much foolery around themes of getting rid of marital and, for that matter, heterosexual duality and going towards homosexuality. Certainly, the gay marriage case has been strongly supported for many of our law schools, but also polyandry, so-called, or rather polyamory, as somebody has labeled it.
That's right. This is one of the very things that was presented to us multitude of times when I was at Yale. We had these advocates for polyamory who would come in, and this is, arguing that, the best state for humans to be in is not in a relationship between a man or a woman, or not even between a man and a man. It's between a man and several women, or several, a woman and several other, the idea that, in a sense, these were presented to us students as, if you're sophisticated enough in your moral understanding, if you can throw off the strictures of religion and tradition, then you will embrace this lifestyle as what's really normal. That we should be more or less like the animals and be breeding around one another. I think, the question about conservative versus liberal, liberalism to me, modern liberalism, not classical liberalism, but modern liberalism has at its core, a moral relativism, an idea that there can be no such thing as an absolute moral standard outside of man himself that we should be measured by. And in that sense, it's really permeates the whole culture. I mean, there's a real sense that any standard outside of my own will, or my own, whatever makes me happy or whatever I feel, that's illegitimate in the eyes of modern liberalism. And so what basis then do we have to have a moral conversation about what should or shouldn't happen within the university walls? If we can't admit to one another, or we can't agree that there even is such thing as a standard, how can we then agree what that standard is?
This leads us to another thing that you've given considerable attention. You talk about what happens within university walls, but you have recently argued in a major article that I've read that university walls are falling and many universities will disappear as the kinds of conventional institutions they have been, to be replaced by essentially digital learning world over.
Yes. An article I penned for the American Interest magazine a little while back, and it got quite a reaction, I guess, out of the world of higher ed, much more than I was expecting. And basically, what I do is take a look at the destructive effects of technology on the business of higher education, and I think this, probably more than anything else, may offer some answers or some solutions in the long run for people who are troubled by the moral direction of our universities, because there's a real potential for the system to be radically changed. And basically, to make a long article short, I argue that if you take a look at the way, for instance, newspaper publishing or book publishing or the music industry, these kinds of businesses that are in the business of selling information of some kind, they have all been radically transformed by the internet and by the ability that we have now to distribute data or information or media for little to no cost. So essentially, the question now is, if you have the ability to record the preeminent lecturers in higher education in the world and distribute those bits of instruction across the globe via, you know, video or audio, what then is the, where then does that leave, the old traditional in-classroom face-to-face experience? And, and it's a long, complicated question, but I think the higher ed industry is in for some huge economic shock over the coming decades as they grapple with this new reality.
That's a very interesting, it's a very interesting problem in what one might call futurology. And you can predict in various ways. You can view with pleasure or with alarm. Roger Kimball, who's a great conservative theorist and writer, the editor of the magazine, and namely, I'm blocking on his name now, but also, of course, the publisher of Encounter Books. The magazine is the New Criterion. Roger is the author of that book of some years ago called Tenured Radicals, in which he argues that the great change in American higher education came when the kids got off the barricades and went back to the universities. Some of them did, got PhDs, and then began to bore from within, march through the institutions. Then they became tenured professors and deans and deanlets, and ultimately college and university presidents, and they've taken over and given us this academic radicalized culture. Part of the radicalization,
Of
that radicalization is what you have focused upon. But he, Roger, views with some pleasure the prospect that the universities will devolve and many of them will disappear, and that will get rid of the left radicalization that has taken over, says he.
I think it has the potential to do quite a bit along that line. I mean, people would be amazed. If you check out the political donations of faculty members in the Ivy League, and this is public information that's available online to anyone who wants to look at it. I think it was 2000. I can't remember if it was 2004 or 2008 presidential election. I believe the ratio of donations to the Democrat candidate rather than the Republican was something like, I think it was 97 or 98% at Yale. And I believe it may have been Princeton that had 100%. there actually wasn't a single donation to the Republican candidate. So, I mean, when we're talking about liberal bias in higher ed, this isn't something that conservatives have made up or something that they've just sort of pulled out of thin air. There's actual data to back this up. You simply have to follow the numbers. And to think that they make a career out of trumpeting for diversity when it comes to one's skin color or one's sexual preference or what have you, yet they have no interest whatsoever in the political diversity, which is at the very heart of the academic enterprise, exchanging ideas and so forth, that they have no trouble with 90, 95 or beyond percent of their faculty having one singular political vision or political view. It just shows you how phony all of these declarations about diversity really are.
Of course. When you were at Yale, did you in any course encounter, did anybody assign to you any writing by Pitirim Sorokin?
No, I don't recall that.
You know, Pitirim Sorokin was a sociologist, professor of sociology at Harvard for all of his American career. He started public life back in Russia, from which he comes, as the secretary to Alexander Kerensky, the first, the head of the first post-Tsarist government that lasted for about a year or less. Sorokin is a great sociologist, and he is a cyclic theorist. He argues that there are three basic kinds of society. Sensate, which is given to the senses, given to the impulses, given to lust and freedom of impulse and so on. Ideational, which tends to grow more reserved and begins to be more and more involved with idea, whether religious or secular. And there is a third, this is almost semi-Marxian, there's idealistic culture, which somehow fuses the both. But basically what you've got is an alternation through history, he says, between sensate and ideational culture. Mm. If old Patiram were alive, I met him once up at Harvard. He was an old man. I was a very, very young one. If he were still alive, he would have to say America was on the path towards developing full sensate culture. By now it has reached the epitome. And therefore, what will be coming in time and signs will begin to show up is a rejection of that sensate culture and a turn towards ideational culture. Do you see any, do you see any such turn towards a rejection of the sensate culture?
You know, that's a deep question, and I don't see that as of yet. I mean, I accept in the sense that I believe that our generation is really facing some profound dysfunction on a grand scale in terms of its ability to relate and to love. There's a big article that came out recently about Japan that's been making the rounds online. You may have seen it. It's about sort of attitudes towards sex among young people in Japan. And the great claim of the article is that young people there are no longer interested in sex. So, you know, Japan, which is a more secular and by some measures, has been steeped in, porn culture, maybe to a greater extent or for a longer period of time than the U.S. Maybe that's an evidence of what you're saying here, that there's almost, it's almost as if the lack of interest in basic human, relationships is the result of taking all of these things to their extreme.
One consequence of that is people don't procreate very much. And indeed, Japan, among civilized, highly industrialized modern societies, has the lowest ratio of birth to death of any in the world. It takes 2.1, as you know, to just replace the population. Japan is coming close to going below 1.0. They are
really
not
sad.
Raising kids. They're not having kids.
It's really sad, and I think, you know, we're living through times where, you know, it's old hat or a poor intellectual trick to blame everything on the internet. But I really think that we're seeing, from a sociological standpoint, profound shifts in the ways humans relate to one another, and certainly the ways they relate to sex, because of how steeped in online communication and pornography and so forth that we really are as a culture now. And that, we're only now beginning to see the first, hint of what that's going to result in. And maybe Japan is an early indicator. And if we're, you know, headed down that same path here in the U.S., it's very troubling.
Troubling indeed. Your book, Sex and God at Yale, Porn, Political Correctness, and A Good Education Gone Bad, was published by St. Martin's Press about a year ago. Is that right?
That's right.
How is it done?
Let's
do some trade gossip.
Well, it hasn't made me a rich man or anything, but it did make waves in the circles where I was hoping it would, and it got it cultivated a lot of interest. Interestingly, on the left, if you look at the press coverage around the book, you know, a lot of the early reviews and coverage were coming from the feminist movement.
Absolutely,
Who had people like Anna
Rosen. I'll tell you what you did, Nathan. You shook them up. I've read those reviews. That woman who reviewed you in the New York Times was badly shaken, and all she could do was relapse into pure contempt.
Well, you know, she wrote a book called The End of NIM, so
her
disapproval as a compliment in a way. you know, these are obviously volatile political issues when it talks about, you know, we'll get to talking about sex and the role between the sexes and everything like that. So, you know, it's controversial stuff. My only hope in putting the book out is that it gets people not only in the Yale community but beyond, because these issues are really affecting all of our, you know, elite higher education system, to sort of wake up and say, hey, you know, it's really almost degenerated to the point where there's very little in the way of serious academic enterprise going on, and there's a real kind of moral corruption going on here. So we need to call into question these institutions that prior to this, everyone pretty much assumed, you know, are a mark of success for young people. Not necessarily so.
I think you've rendered a very valuable service with this book. And of course, it's also eminently readable, even though it produces a shock reaction every fourth page at least. But I think Sex and God at Yale is essential reading, especially for parents who are concerned about their high school kids applying to college. Would you really want to send your kid to Yale these days? I know that my kid didn't go to Yale, and he's long since graduated from college. But I do have a youngster, a grandson who's just finished high school and is starting in college. But I advised, not that his parents were thinking of sending him to Yale, but I said, don't send him to Yale. And don't send him to Princeton or Harvard either. And he's wound up in a major. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, you mentioned Hillsdale earlier, and you know, I had the privilege of going and giving a little talk there about a year ago, and I was tremendously impressed with that place.
Yeah, they're a fine institution. Yeah.
So there are places out there, but you gotta, you know, buyer beware. You gotta know what you're paying for.
But the major universities don't quite afford that sort of culture anymore, do they? Hillsdale is dedicated to celebrating the virtues of Republican government, of the American founding fathers, and of the philosophers who stood behind the American founding fathers, as well as the classics and so on. Hillsdale is anomalous in the general American academic culture these days.
It is.
Though there are other such institutions, usually at the college level. Well, listen, I really mean my commendation of your book. I think it's a very valuable contribution, and I'm very happy to recommend it to all of our listeners who have not yet taken a look at it. And just say one quick word, if you would, about the website that you now operate.
Oh, yes. TheCollegeFix.com. I edit a host of conservative writers from campuses all around the country. So we're bringing up, telling people every day about all the crazy stuff liberals are doing. So if you want to find out what's really happening on our campuses, you know, visit thecollegefix.com. And we think that light is the best disinfectant out there. So our job is to report on what's happening on these campuses. And we do that every week. I see something that I think I can be shocked no more, but I'm shocked again.
Well, maintain your capacity for shock, because there's a lot of shocking stuff out there. And please accept my warm thanks for joining us today. Excellent.
Thanks for having me on the program, Milt.
My great pleasure. Thank you again.